open a public hearing on House Bill 2575. Jim, would you read us a staff summary, please?
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2575 allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to set the time period for issuance of the initial teaching, personnel service, and administrative licenses, modifies the requirements for the issuance of continuing teaching, personnel service, and administrative licenses, declares an emergency, and takes effect on passage.
Okay. Committee, you recall that when Vicki Chamberlain was here before, we had others who wanted to testify. We also had a pretty, I thought, a very good discussion, actually. We had lots of questions, and so we asked Vicki to come back, and so she is here today. And with that, we'll call to the testimony table Vicki Chamberlain, TSPC.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. That's how long my day's been. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And what I brought back with me today was some answers to some questions that were raised last time and the administrative rules around the license. I know that Representative Avakian had a question about that. And to answer any other questions and give some of our stakeholders an opportunity to give their perspective on the bill, too. One of the questions that Representative Nolan asked was the degree, percentage of folks who had a graduate degree. And the Oregon Report Card reports that 45% of teachers do and about 47% of all educators, so in Oregon. Where the
Vicki, was that master's degree, you mean?
Any postgraduate.
Okay.
It's about 47% reported that they had a master's degree and about 0.4% reported they had doctorates. And we are the highest rate of master's and graduate degrees in the western states, and the top paragraph actually gives a little breakdown of that. One of the things I want to note about that is that Oregon also has a strong program of partnership with the community colleges, and it is master's degrees teachers who teach college-level courses on those college curriculums for the 2+2, and that may be another reason that we're ahead in the West. But I'll hand this out.
Oh,
then I thought it may be helpful to just have the administrative rules for these licenses so that you can take a look. But what I also brought was on the blue piece of paper is the administrative rules for the standard license, which was the second stage top level license you could get in Oregon prior to the new licensure system. And this rule is the rule that required, if you're teaching in high school, that you had to have a fifth year of graduate credits or you had to have a master's degree, and it prescribes what education courses you need to take. So that's on this. And while I'm at it, I'll hand out also the administrative rules on the new licensure. For the committee's information, I've had one conversation with Chair Backlund and about the master's degree requirement. The commission meets next Thursday and Friday, and I have put on the agenda the discussion of the issues around the master's degree. They are aware of some of the issues because they've heard of them, and I've been forwarding correspondence since I arrived on the issue, and I will be able to come back to the committee, it looks like, around March 19th and have a further conversation with you about that requirement. Then the final piece of information I have for you, I don't recall who asked for it, but these are the passage rates on the subject matter tests that Oregon requires for licensure. And it's actually kind of interesting. It also gives you the number of folks who took them within the last 2 years. So that was the information I was bringing back and responding to questions. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there aren't any questions, I didn't have anything else to present today.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki, did I understand process-wise when you say that you're taking this discussion as an agenda item to the TSPC, the commission? Are you looking for concurrence from them, from direction from them? The purpose of having it as a discussion item is what?
I think there's several purposes. One purpose is to alert them that this is a an issue of high interest here at the Capitol. It's come up, and it came up in our budget hearing meetings, and it's come up in this committee. And this is a fairly new commission. There are just only a few folks who were here in 1999 when the new licensure system came in. And to be perfectly honest with you, I cannot find any record of a policy discussion around the master's degree requirement. And so, you know, that's why I can't come prepared to you to say, well, we had all this discussion and then this was why this resulted. So I think that at a minimum, they have to consider on the record why they would consider that to be, in the same way you would on a statute, a good public policy to require the master's degree for the second stage license. And I'm virtually certain also that as a commission, they haven't had a policy discussion about reasons why that might be a complicated requirement. So what I want to do is give you good faith evidence that we will deal with the issue between now and the next session.
Good. Thank you.
And Vicki, this will be your first meeting with the commission?
On this issue. My first meeting was last July. Oh, okay. This will be my fourth meeting.
I see. Very good. Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your coming back, and certainly you've, I hope, not inundated us with materials, but you've given us a lot of materials to have for our records.
They might be helpful when we come back, Mr. Chair, and talk about the bill in a work session. We can refer to them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bill Beck.
The rosebud needs to be between the thorns.
And Courtney, you've come up too. Good, good. I didn't realize you were a tag team of three. We've added a third partner here. Oh, please, go ahead.
Yes, Chair Backlund and members of the committee, my name is Bill Beck, and I'm Director of Professional Development for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. In addition to working with administrators around the state and their professional development needs, I also serve as a liaison to the Teacher Standard and Practices Commission for our organization. Have with me today the Chair of the Licensure Committee, which I staff. And the licensure committee is made up of representatives from all of the four departments of COSA. So we have superintendents, principals, and central office directors on that committee, as well as representatives from all of the six universities or institutions in Oregon that have administrative licensure programs. Vicki Chamberlain, executive director of TSPC, sits on that committee with us, as well as the representative from the Oregon School Personnel Association and a representative from the Oregon School Boards Association. So we really have a group of individuals who have a vested interest in a variety of issues around administrative licensure, and we've also gotten very involved in the initial and continuing licensure issues for teachers because of the potential impact that has on our members in terms of who they have available to work in classrooms. So that's Jack is going to talk a bit about the work on our committee and some issues, but I wanted to provide you with an opportunity to understand COSA has, this isn't just an issue for COSA, it's an issue for all of those folks that we have at the table, and we're pretty much in agreement on what our concerns are. As I've worked over the past 4.5 years with TSPC, one of the things that we've learned to focus on is to maintain as much flexibility as we can possibly have for schools and districts in order for them to staff their schools with high-quality individuals. Interesting a statistic about Oregon, and I'm sure you know this, but in the context of my comments, 50% of the school districts in Oregon have an average size of the population size of 313 students. 50% of the students in Oregon attend the 18 largest districts in the state. So the diversity of need that districts have is huge. And there's one plan to fit all of those individuals, and that's why we seek very strongly to work very hard to maintain as much flexibility as we possibly can. We want a plan that works as well in Portland as it does in Pilot Rock. I believe you me, I've been in both places, worked in one and visited another, and they have very diverse needs. We have brought together COSA, OEA, OSBA, Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon School Personnel Association. We've also began conversations with the Oregon Association for ESDs. They're a key player in this, and what we're hoping to be able to do, if we're successful in convincing you to move forward and we get enough support to pass House Bill 2575, to have time for folks to come to the table and really take a hard look at how we can implement this plan. We've got folks across the state that are very isolated and have to have access to the same kinds of programs that people who live in the Portland metro area have to have. The ESDs are in a great position to serve those needs, and under the OARs that we have that govern the operation of the initial and continuing licenses, ESDs can in fact do that once they have approval from the commission. So we want to have flexibility, we want to have a program that fits the needs of districts across the state, and we need the time to do that. We have a number of teachers out there who are in their last couple of years before the hammer falls, and if they haven't completed the work that they need to get done, they're going to be in serious trouble, as well as the districts in which they work. So we urge you to support this bill, and we know that we have a good deal of faith and trust in the commission and in Vicki's leadership there, that we can come out with a bill or with a set of rules that will enable us to have high-quality folks in classrooms and at the same time a plan that will meet everybody's needs. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jack Stoop, Superintendent of Yamhill ESD and Chair of the Licensure and Preparation Committee for COSA. I've been a member of the committee for 3 years and chair of this current year. As Bill said, we have members from all over the state who are practitioners, licensed administrators in the state, as well as then teacher preparation and administrative preparation sites who are members. All of these folks have expressed a sincere concern about the timeline and the lack of flexibility with the initial and the move toward the continuing teacher license. When I was superintendent of Lincoln County School District, I had a difficult time getting teachers who didn't have to worry about the initial and the standard. It was the initial and the continuing. It was the standard. And I think this will complicate matters even more and could leave individuals without their license and leave districts without the ability to hire people that they need to teach the high-quality classes that the 21st Century Education Act and No Child Left Behind require. So I'm urging your support of 2575. I would like to add that the committee, the Licensure and Preparation Committee for COSA, is very pleased with the accessibility that Vicki Chamberlain has provided to us, and she attends our meetings. She's sensitive to the issues and concerns that districts have and that administrators have about the potential continuing or perhaps even increased shortage of teachers, and she's been really an asset to us and has always made herself available to us, and we appreciate that leadership very much. Thank you.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, I'm Courtney Vanderstack, and I'm the Associate Executive Director for the Oregon Education Association. My role at OEA is to run the Center for Teaching and Learning, and part of our responsibility in the center is to be the liaison to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. From my perspective, more importantly, our role is to help our members be sure that they are providing high-quality instruction out in the classrooms across the state.
OEA has been concerned about the current requirements of the initial and continuing license due to the constraints it puts on our members and districts and the lack of flexibility it offers us as a state to welcome teachers from out of state into our state to help meet the needs that we have in our classrooms. We believe that House Bill 2575 will certainly help the commission be able to address those issues, but that it currently it's like the commission's hands are tied. And so regardless of the issues that all of us as partners have brought to the commission and their willingness to work with us, we can't do anything because of the time constraints under the current statute. And so having that flexibility to try and figure out what is the best way to assure that we have high-quality educators in all our classrooms, not only because we know that's what's best for our students, but also because now federal legislation has put some pretty stringent requirements around that with the No Child Left Behind Act. So the ability to have some flexibility and time to work out all those alternative methods that Mr. Beck referenced, the access issues for our rural areas, then making sure that the additional requirements that we're asking of our teachers are really those that are going to make a difference in the classroom. Those are the kinds of issues we want to be able to address that we currently have lots of questions around but no ability to get at because of those time constraints. So we would urge you to pass this legislation and so that we can continue our work with the commission. And I thank you for your time today.
Okay, so I think I'm hearing lots of folks use the word flexibility. We need flexibility, and I think probably that's kind of where the chair is coming from. And the committee, we had a possible work session scheduled today, but I think we want to wait for the result of the March 6-7 meeting, and Vicki alluded to perhaps a March 19 meeting, and so I think probably it would be wise for us to wait until we hear further on some of these issues. So we will not go to a work session today. We will do that at a later time. Yes. And we have one other person to testify, I'm sorry, Jim Green. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I'll keep my comments brief just to say we as the Oregon School Boards Association support the bill. The timelines that are in statute don't offer the flexibility, and I understand that's kind of the buzzword with this bill, but you've charged as the legislature, the commission, the authority over licensed educators in the state, and we believe that this is the commission and the place where the discussion should occur on the professionality and all the other things that need to go along. We are not backing away from standards and the high standards we want for our educators in any way, shape, or form by doing this. The continuing professional development is still there, and it's still a key component of educators and their relicensure issues. And also the No Child Left Behind Act, which we are beginning to implement in the state of Oregon, and the processes that we've gone through with that are also adding to the professionalism and the standards of educators. And we would just encourage you to pass this bill as soon as possible. I spoke with Ms. Chamberlain on this issue, and I take her at her word that the commission will deal with these issues, and they will be on the agenda, and I know the commission will hopefully deal with these in a way that is satisfactory to this committee.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Well, you're a man of your word, Jim. You said you'd be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, then, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2575. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2621.
Chair and committee, House Bill 2621 allows a person adversely affected by rule of a voluntary organization administering interscholastic activities to seek review to determine whether the rule conflicts with state law or rules of the State Board of Education. Provides expedited review process, entitled person who sought review of the rule to recover damages and legal fees if the rule conflicts with state law or rules of the board. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. Thank you, Jim. Okay. Could Randy Harnish come up, please?
Excuse my voice. I'm losing it off and on the last couple of days. Chair Backlund, members of the committee, my name is Randy Harnish. I'm with the Department of Education, work with the State Board of Education, and I wanted to give you, again, a very brief overview of the process that the department and the board use in approving interscholastic activity organizations. We are authorized by statute to approve all organizations that administer interscholastic activities within the state. This approval process is set out in administrative rule and basically requires the organizations to submit an application containing a variety of information as far as location, the scope of the activities that are offered. We ask for a statement of the organization's purpose, including its charter, constitution, and bylaws, a copy of the most recent set of financial statements, academic and behavioral standards for student participation, and then again an additional piece is an assurance that the organization will comply with all state and federal laws regarding Oregon public school students and administrative rules, that they agree not to discriminate as defined in statute, and that they complement the state board functions. This approval is made for a period of 5 years. We are currently in the middle of, well, the last approval was in 2001, and we have 10 organizations currently on the approved list. They range from the Oregon Dressage Society, which sponsors horseback riding, for lack of a better term, events, and the Oregon Water Polo Committee to the Oregon School Activities Association, which is by far the largest and most comprehensive of these organizations. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You generated a question, Randy. Why doesn't the water polo group find itself under the auspices of OSAA?
Chair Backlund, Representative Hobson, I'm not exactly sure, but that would probably be a question that would be more appropriately directed to the OSAA representatives.
Representative, I see those representatives from the OSAA nodding affirmatively, so perhaps you can save that and re-ask it at that time. Randy, would you, this is kind of an evaluation type question, would you say, or would you evaluate the current arrangement to be a successful one, a working one that's going okay or going well?
It is, I believe it is an effective process in that not too many appeals get to the state board. The OSCA and the other organizations deal with those questions at their level through their own processes, and only those that few that have serious concerns about the rightness of that decision make that take that appeal to the state board. And then our process, we try to deal with them as expeditiously as possible within folks' schedules and get answers out as quickly as possible, knowing that in most cases there's a kid somewhere who wants to play something and is waiting for a decision, and we try our very best to get that decision back to them as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Okay. Tom Welter. And you can bring your associates with you, too, if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Welter. I'm the executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association. We're here today to speak about some concerns to the current language in House Bill 2621. We have provided some written materials for you to review. I want to briefly walk through those a little bit and tell you who the OSAA is. The Oregon School Activities Association is, as the previous speaker, we're approved every 5 years by the State Board of Education. We currently have 287 member high schools that belong, that voluntarily belong to the OSAA. That includes 232 public schools and 55 private schools. Also included in that are 37 associate member schools, which are small private schools that are so small they don't offer any programs of their own. They become an associate member so that their students may participate in programs at their resident public school, so that they have an opportunity to participate as well. Each year we conduct 80 state championships in 16 different activities that are sponsored by the association. Last year our surveys indicated that approximately 115,000 students in our member high schools participated in activity programs that were sponsored by the OSAA. We're not a unique organization in that each state has a similar type organization. We belong to a national organization called the National Federation of State High School Associations, and together we work to make common playing rules for all of the sports and activities that we sponsor. We're a voluntary organization. We're a private nonprofit organization. The 287 schools are divided into leagues. Each of those leagues selects one school administrator, principal, or superintendent to represent their league in our rules-making body, which is our delegate assembly. You have a copy of the members of our delegate assembly. It ranges across the state. We incorporate... Our smallest school is Spray High School in Eastern Oregon, has about 20 students, up to Westview High School in Beaverton, which has probably 2,220 students. So we have a wide range of school sizes and certainly a wide range of school geographies that we deal with in our association. We have a 10-member executive board elected by the membership. Again, those 10 people vote and set the rules, regulations, and policies of the organization in conjunction with our delegate assembly. Again, there, as you see from the roster of our executive board members, they range from superintendents in NISA and Lakeview and Klamath Falls to metropolitan areas, a member from the Salem area, Hillsboro, and Canby. While we're a private nonprofit organization, every year we are audited, and by constitution, any money, any revenues that we generate must be given back to our member schools. Last year, we reimbursed our member schools over $740,000 to help offset the expenses that they incur in participating in our state championship activities. That amount of money is well over three times as much money as our member schools pay in membership dues and fees to belong to the organization. And now I'd like to let our legal counsel, Don Carter, explain how our process works in regards to the eligibility of transfer students.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Don Carter. I'm the attorney for the Oregon School Activities Association, and I'm privileged to have served in that role for a number of years. And I can speak to the number of cases that have come to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction since ORS 339-450 was adopted in 1983. And it was a case involving that statute that I think gives rise to this, the legislation that you're faced with today. Since 1983, the Oregon School Activities Association has been involved with 28 cases, as I said in the written testimony, that have come before the State Superintendent of Public Instruction regarding eligibility issues. And of those, actually 29 cases, of those cases, the OSAA has been ruled against by the State Superintendent in one case, and that was a case that occurred in the fall of last year. It involved a student who transferred several times from a private school to a public school and back to a private school. And the question presented first internally at the OSAA and then to the state superintendent was whether OSAA violated ORS 339-450 when it denied eligibility to that student. The state superintendent of public instruction by rule appoints a hearings officer to hear the case and make proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. The hearings officer in this particular case did a very careful review of the legislative history of the statute from 1983 and found and said in his opinion, in his proposed opinion, that it was a very close question whether the particular transfer in question here was permitted by or prohibited by the statute. Ultimately, the hearings officer proposed that the superintendent adopt a finding that the OSA had violated the law by denying eligibility in this particular case. That proposed opinion has not yet been formally adopted as an opinion of the state superintendent of the public of public instruction, but as a consequence of that decision, the OSAA has done several things. It has not appealed and does not intend to appeal from that determination. And in fact, it adopted an interim rule within days of that hearings officer's opinion that specifically said that any similar transfers are not going to be cause for denial of eligibility. And a memorandum, Mr. Welter will, I think, describe in greater detail some of the steps that were taken. But I think what I'd like to describe very briefly for you is the process by which appeals are considered, both internal to the organization and then before the state superintendent of public instruction, and describe this particular case so that you'll have an understanding of how these cases arise. In a typical case, a student is denied eligibility because of a transfer problem. The student is attending school at a place other than where the student's parents reside. That's the fundamental rule of the association, that a student should be attending the school where the student's parents reside unless there are other reasons why that shouldn't be. And the Oregon School Activities Association has adopted a process by which a student who does not meet the requirements of the rules can seek an exception to the rules and be permitted to participate in any event. That first level of appeal is to three superintendents or administrators from the league in which this student seeks to participate. And those three people meet, determine whether the student should be granted an exception to the rules. If the student is denied eligibility, the student has the opportunity to appeal that decision to an eligibility appeals board that consists of five individuals, two persons who may have no connection with schools at all, two administrators or athletic directors or other people. It's a five-member panel drawn from around the state of Oregon, so they're unlikely to be biased against a particular school or a student participating at a particular school. And that eligibility appeals board meets, determines whether there is reason to change the determination made by the district athletic committee. And from there, the student has the right to appeal to the state superintendent of public instruction. And in this particular case, the hearing before the district athletic committee was on September 2nd. The student was denied eligibility. On September 5th, a five-member panel was convened, and the student was able to bring an appeal to the eligibility appeals board. Then on September 24th, September 25th, the State Department of Education appointed the hearings officer, as I already indicated, and he conducted the hearing and rendered an opinion on October 4th. So you can see that the appeals process here was very rapid, and in my experience as counsel for the OSAA, the State Department of Education receives an appeal, appoints a hearings officer within a matter of hours or a day or so, the hearings officer contacts me and we arrange hearings very rapidly. The timing has not been an issue, I do not believe, for the State Department of Education or for the Oregon School Activities Association. We understand that the issues here are very important to students and that it is very desirable to quickly meet to hear those cases. And so in this case, there was a month and one day between the first hearing before the district athletic committee and the final decision of the hearings officer for the state superintendent of public instruction. That seems to me to be an extremely rapid process to go through three levels of hearings and allow a student the opportunity to make the student's case. I've presented statistics indicating that OSAA gets, on an average, 272 appeals of eligibility appeals a year. 272 a year. And those go to the district athletic committee. 28 then were, on average, have been denied over the last 6 years, 28 a year. And of those denials, 10 on average have been appealed to the Eligibility Appeals Board. And 7 determinations on average have ultimately been that the student is denied the right to participate. From the statistics I've already given you, you can see that there's about 1 a year of those that goes to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. I said 29 over the last 20 years, so 1.3 or whatever the math is. So as you can see, most of these students, over 90% of them, are ultimately allowed the opportunity to participate. Those that are not are given a multi-level appeals process. I think it's a careful process involving both professional educators and lay citizens who have an interest. And then it goes to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. It's our position that in view of the fact that over the last 20 years, this is the first case and the only case in which there's been a determination that OSAA denied eligibility in violation of state law, that there is not a necessity for this statute that imposes damages and attorney fees in the event the student ultimately prevails in that case. It isn't a reciprocal provision. And remember, the members of the Oregon School Activities Association are the public and private high schools of the state of Oregon, and they are ultimately paying the legal fees and the costs of going through the process, and that's the internal processes are part of the cost of doing business. Hiring an attorney and appearing in a contested case proceeding before the State Superintendent of Public Instruction is an added cost, and then to require the OSAA to bear that responsibility doesn't seem warranted by the facts that have occurred in the last 20 years. If you make a different determination and determine that it is appropriate for an award of attorney fees to be made under those circumstances, it seems to me that you have to recognize that that can increase the number of cases that are appealed to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. There is less of a disincentive to appeal those cases. There's an incentive really to appeal because it's possible that the superintendent will overturn that decision. I think that will result in greater expense not only to the Oregon School Activities Association but to the State Board of Education, the State Department of Education, and I think that's something that should be considered. I would like to talk very briefly about the damages provision. There is a provision in Section 3 of the Section 1, I'll start that again. There is a provision in Section 1 of the bill, paragraph 3C, that the person who seeks review of the rules of the rule is entitled to recover damages and reasonable legal fees. I have difficulty understanding what those damages might be in a monetary sense. I don't know how the State Superintendent of Public Instruction could possibly come up with a damage calculation for denial of eligibility. So from a legal point of view, from a history point of view, the Oregon School Activities Association urges that that this bill not proceed. Thank you.
In response to an earlier question that was posed regarding water polo, the Oregon School Activities Association has a bylaw that says that we will consider sponsorship of an activity if 50% of the schools in a classification sponsor it. We have 81 schools at our 4A classification, our largest schools, and so we would need 41 schools to reach that 50% threshold. Our last conversations with the Water Polo Association, they had approximately 23 schools that sponsored water polo. So there are several activities that some of our member schools sponsor, but we don't sponsor because it doesn't reach that threshold, like water polo, rodeo, ski racing, and those types of things. There aren't enough schools to meet our bylaw that we would consider sponsorship of those activities at this point in time. Would be open to any questions.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. John Mack?
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Mack. I'm here on behalf of my son, Cole Mack, of 12929 Southeast 130th, Clackamas, Oregon. I am generally in support of House Bill 2621. At a time when schools are struggling to find money to save their sports programs, the Oregon School Activities Association is paying its lawyers tens of thousands of dollars to keep my son and his teammates at Portland Adventist Academy out of the Oregon 2A basketball tournament. The story of PAA's long and tortured dealings with OSAA will demonstrate why passage of House Bill 2621 is necessary. PAA is a respected member of its league. The PAA boys team has won league sportsmanship awards 12 out of the last 14 years. The OSAA admits the PAA has never been tainted by accusations of recruiting, as have some other private schools. During the flooding in 1996, just to show our kids are decent kids, PAA bused students to league rival Vernonia High School to help clean up after flooding damaged the school. A few days later, when Vernonia's basketball team came to play at PAA, all of the funds that were brought in at the game were also donated to the school. PAA students are also Seventh-day Adventists. Seventh-day Adventists do not believe in participating in competitive sports from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, their Sabbath. Because there's an 8% chance that PAA might be scheduled to play one game during the 2A basketball tournament before sundown on Saturday, they have been shut out of that tournament for years. The fix is easy. The Oregon School Activities Association could allow PAA to play any Saturday game after sundown. In fact, in 1996, the OSAA staff strongly recommended that exact solution, and every member of the OSAA executive board who cast a ballot voted in favor of that proposal. Unfortunately, the OSAA reversed itself after a few schools complained. Nearly 3 years ago, several PAA parents again asked the OSAA to make a minor adjustment that would allow their children to have the same opportunity to participate in the state basketball tournament as students of other religions have. The OSAA refused. Those parents appealed to the State Board of Education under both Oregon law and the Oregon Constitution. Oregon Revised Statute 659.850 expressly prohibits discrimination in interscholastic activities on the basis of religion, even when the discrimination is unintended. Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution prohibits any government act that interferes with rights of conscience. The OSAA's discrimination is obvious when one realizes that the OSAA has delayed tournament games for a number of secular reasons, including to accommodate a team's travel needs. On the other hand, it flatly refuses to extend the same courtesy to accommodate sincerely held religious beliefs. More than a year after the parents appealed, and more than 7 months after the hearing was held, so I would have to disagree with the speed of which these hearings take place, the kids won a temporary victory when an independent hearing officer concluded that the OSAA had violated both Oregon law and the Oregon Constitution when it refused to accommodate the PAA students' religious beliefs. Unfortunately, on the eve of the 2002 basketball tournament, the Board of Education, under the Honorable Stan Bunn, rejected the hearing officer's conclusion and instead ruled in favor of the OSAA. PAA's boys won the Northwest League Championship this past Monday night, which is why my voice is a little hoarse. Tomorrow, the Court of Appeals will decide whether they will be able to compete in this year's tournament. In a 1996 internal memo, the OSAA admitted that it would be relatively easy to solve this problem. Instead, the OSAA has spent tens of thousands of dollars over nearly 3 years to make sure students of a minority religion cannot participate in the state basketball tournament unless they agree to violate their beliefs. PAA is just one example of OSAA's arrogance in dealing with student-athletes. The OSAA mission statement says that its primary goal is to promote and provide equitable participation opportunities for students. For too long, the OSAA has treated schools, parents, and students as the enemy. For too long, the OSAA has been more concerned about beating that enemy than is figuring out how to increase participation opportunities for all Oregon students. House Bill 2621 reflects the frustration that too many schools, parents, and students have had with the OSAA's tactics. There's only one problem with House Bill 2621. As currently drafted, people won't have time to review the OSAA's records. PAA has a good chance of winning its claim against the OSAA, in part because of information that it learned during discovery. To preserve that right for others, I suggest one modification to House Bill 2621. Add the words, unless the person appealing the decision agrees to an extension of that time period, to the end of the next to the last sentence of Section 1B, line 26. Thus, the sentence as revised would read, a final order, whether entered by the board or a hearing officer, must be entered within 10 days after the date the decision of the voluntary organization is appealed, unless the person appealing the decision agrees to an extension of that time period. With that modification, I urge the legislature to adopt House Bill 2621. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I can take any questions if you have.
Okay. Well, John, then tomorrow, the Court of Appeals will make a decision.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, appreciate your testimony,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Barr.
Thank you. I'm really intrigued by the this entire situation. You said that that on numerous occasions game times have been delayed for secular reasons. You mentioned travel time. Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other reasons that game times have been changed?
I don't have all the specifics, to be honest with you, but I know there's been other situations as well where they have changed times.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You refer in your testimony to OSAA's arrogance and its treatment of schools and students and parents as the enemy. And I guess I would ask if you have read their mission statement and it being formed by member schools, and if you're aware that schools from all over the state, representing 287 schools, actually make the rules?
Mm-hmm. I'm aware of that. But they're not following their own rules.
May I follow?
Follow up.
Thank you. Could you explain that for me, please?
They're making a discrimination as to religious beliefs in their structure with a very small adjustment. Last year, if I could give you an example, our team was allowed to go to state, and it's no problem if we win every game. We do not have to play on Friday night or Saturday. We happened to lose our Friday afternoon game. We went to the state tournament with our ruling in our favor that said they did have to make accommodation. Honorable Stan Bunn's office overruled that decision on Friday morning. We didn't find out till Friday afternoon after we lost the game they were not going to make accommodation. At that point, we told them that we were going to forfeit the game, and we left town. Therefore, and I understand the problem. Nobody wants to forfeit a game. Nobody wants a team to be in a situation where they can't play. So I would say that they don't abide by their own rules in accommodating.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me to understand what process you would see as being better than a representative group of people making the decisions with an adequate appeals process. What would be a better way to address these issues?
Oh, I think the appeals process is appropriate. But there needs to be, we have spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars fighting this issue since 1996, as well as the OSAA. And there needs to be something put into place that gives some teeth to the fact that we don't fight issues that are not in support of students. That's my feeling.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
That concludes those who have signed up. Does anyone else, or do anyone, or would anyone like to also testify? Okay. Okay. Well, today is a public hearing. We may have some amendments to be considered at a later time. I think our committee administrator is working on that. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Okay. And so when those are prepared, we will reschedule and consider those amendments. With that, then, we will adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2621, and we'll make a double tap and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.